unfolding together in Dialogue Village.
It's just started raining here. I thought it was horses' hooves. And last night we had a fan on because it was hot. And the fan, every time it moved to the right, it would catch the curtains a little bit. And honestly, for about 20 minutes, I thought it was a helicopter circling the sky around. And I even went outside to see if I could see it. I said to my wife, oh, well, I realized, because I just settled down like you just did then. I just settled and just did one of those like tuning in moments. I looked at the fan, enjoying its breeze, and then I connected the noise. And I said to her, you know, for 20 minutes, I just thought there's a helicopter circling around. Something must be going on. And she just looked at me. She goes, are you tripping? And she knows I'm not tripping. That was a quite funny reaction. Anyway, right. So let me just go on myself as the host. Jacob, thank you for responding to my post to talk to people. It's great. I love the way that you've just shot an arrow over to me on the messaging, and then I looked at what you're about and transformative dialogue and consciousness, and I think I already met a kindred spirit and I feel connected to you. So I think people who are listening or watching this generally know a little bit about what the podcast's about. It's not easy to explain in a nutshell. I don't really have an elevator pitch or anything, but anyone listening, let's say they might be able to feel their way into our conversation, our connection right now, this live connection. There's just one practical thing I want to ask you before I ask you to introduce yourself. And that's just simply, where are you? Because that geography is really important to me.
I'm in Bergerac, France, which is quite near to Bordeaux. And I'm staying.
Do you know where I am?
Where?
I'm in Villarreal. It's about 20 minutes from Bergerac.
No.
Yeah.
You live here.
At the moment, I came on a visa.
Okay. Right. Well, I guess we're going to be having a coffee in the next weekend or something.
Wow. Imagine. Wow. You heard it here. My dad lives not far from Bergerac, between here and Bergerac. But yeah, I've been here. I've been in France a couple of months. Wow. And I'm going to be here till spring, probably next year.
Already off to an interesting start then. So just to clarify that, I usually live in Germany, from the UK. Yep. I live in South Germany, in a little village in Bavaria. And I'm currently staying for a month at the Life Itself community in Bergerac, which maybe you've heard of. It's an intentional community here, and I'm doing a residency here for a month and exploring dialogue and different practices, and light and shadow and integration.
Fantastic. I mean, that I did reach out to them when I came across them a few weeks ago, and I thought about doing the residency. Upcoming stuff going on looks really interesting, but I'm just a bit tied down myself with work, and got guests coming over. So that was great to find out about that place. Is it going well?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's been, it's caught me at a period of very big life transition. And so it's really been an opportunity to see what it's like to sort of be in community, be in dialogue. You know, we're also doing a lot of singing and different practices, and it's been very supportive of me navigating a lot of uncertainty about sort of where I'm going to live next and my future path and relationship and so on. So yeah, it's been wonderful, and it's my first experience of living in community in this way.
Did you come down to France especially for that?
Yeah, I came on the train from Salzburg.
Because they have a hub in Berlin as well. Is that you connected to that?
I know a couple of people there, yeah.
Yeah. Now it was really made me happy to see that center there. So I didn't, I've been working in dialogue mostly in autism and neurodiversity for about 5 years. And my reasons for getting out of the city are quite typical ones, but I've always been drawn to the countryside and peace and quiet, needing that healing. And you can't deny the French way of life is something to be relished and admired. But not knowing that many people out here at all and seeing that place there was something that cheered me up. So I did reach out and had a conversation with somebody there on the email, and I'm still getting over the fact that you're there. That was a wonderful, wonderful serendipity. Hmm. So do you want to say a little bit about your interests, your work, and you've got a master's in terrorism, security and society, which is really fascinating to me as well. Hmm. Anything, wherever you want to start, or we can just have a conversation.
Okay. Yeah. Love to. Gosh, my path has taken me through quite a few different areas of interest, mostly guided by my curiosity and just sort of following that. And sometimes it's led me really deep into something, and then it's come to an end, and I've then had sort of return to that curiosity and follow it next where I wanted to go. And so today, my core work, my life work, my life practice is dialogue also. And about two and a half years ago, I began observing and participating in these dialogues that were happening, particularly on YouTube, between cognitive scientists and philosophers and others. And they were exploring this idea of dialogos. That's kind of dia logos through logos. And it's sort of this deeper primordial sense of the word and the spoken word as something like living and creative that organizes reality, that makes sense of things. And so I was really captivated when I saw that, and I was so drawn to participate in it myself that I started a podcast project called Sense Space. And Sense Space was really a space for making sense. I was talking about all manner of different aspects of modern life. But it had this distinct emphasis on the how of dialogue as well, of that sensing into the space, of that taking the time to really drop in, to slow down. And this journey has developed over the last few years into me launching my own practice, working with people one-to-one. And I've also been involved in men's work and men's circles. And I'm very interested in the intersection of this kind of dialogue, which I call transformative dialogue, and men's circles. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, the essence of it is that there is a transformation, there's a shift in state that occurs. And so we don't just have a discussion where we're exchanging knowledge and content, and we, you know, we both sort of stay securely in ourselves as we usually are. There's a kind of receptivity to be changed by the other and to go on a journey. And how that unfolds and what that looks like is totally unique to each person that I speak with. But some of the core elements might be things like a really deep sense of listening that kind of calls out depth in the other person, moving into more of a kind of conversational flow where we don't think too much about what we're saying and speak something new, maybe reach an insight. And ultimately, through that process of really deeply listening to one another and that back and forth, getting to a place where there is a kind of we space that we're in, and there's a collective wisdom that that space can have, that we can kind of access an intelligence or a wisdom that is beyond what we would individually access. And that can be very healing as well. So that's sort of what I'm doing today. I had a many years research track exploring Islam and its relation to the West and jihadism and political Islam. And that obviously is a very fraught kind of cultural dialogue. But today it's taken more of a philosophical turn, and I've been on my own journey of healing, of trauma healing, and much of that has been precipitated by exploration of plant medicine and psychedelics, as well as deeper connection with nature. And so I bring all of these things to bear in dialogue, and I am someone who, you know, I've never been diagnosed as autistic, but I'm pretty sure I am. and so I've always wanted to explore that a bit more. And when I saw your work at the intersection of autism and dialogue, I was like, yeah, this is something I really need to have a conversation about.
Cool. Okay, well, let me catch up a little bit with you. Just on that last point, the strongest part is to do with well, I was introduced to Bohm, David Bohm, in 2010, and there was something that I couldn't explain the way that connected with it on my fine art degree. A few years later, I got my diagnosis of Asperger's, and the words autism dialogue popped into my head, thinking about Bohm and how it's generative, and how he places, he advocated for something called the Rheo mode, R-H-E-O, Greek, meaning flow, river, more emphasis on the verb in language. So advocating for more of a verb-based language, which really suits the autistic brain wiring, in that with filtering and experience. And Erin Manning says autism is the direct perception of the forming of experience.
Wow. I have never heard anybody speak about autism in that way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So linking with something else, a couple of other things you said. So back as a teenager, I took mushrooms as a way of freedom, really, from the constraints of family and school and society and everything. When I was I think 15, and that just new world opened up for me for a few years. And then I realized that I needed, deep down, I realized that this wasn't going to work forever. And I hit a crisis point. And within a couple of weeks of hitting a crisis, I met a Sufi master. And I took allegiance with a sheikh. And that was it. Oh, literally overnight, I dropped everything. And I was a murid in the Naqshbandi order for over 20 years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm talking about, and I just remember seeing something to do with Islam on your webpage. And then I think maybe 22 or 23 years later, my life went through another huge dramatic shift, and the framework of Sufism, the scaffolding, it was almost like a scaffolding of being, that part of it dissolved in a very painful couple of years. And my life completely changed again. And that was at a similar time when I went to uni as a mature student and got introduced to BOHM. And then it was a few years later when I got my diagnosis of Asperger's, looking for a way to reintegrate into society, really, because I was still struggling. So I got that, I got the diagnosis, and then yeah, interestingly, I went and got towards the end of that period, that 22 year period, I got a postgrad in Muslim chaplaincy. That was me really trying to get to grips with the link of this massive cultural dilemmas and finding my place in the world, basically. That was it. That was almost the end of that kind of esoteric Islam, the whole period and way of looking at the world. And so then Asperger's and dialogue converged, and that's where I've been mostly for the last 5 years or so. And it's been a fascinating journey, but I don't talk to many people about the Sufi years, because it's just, as you'll know, it's not really understood, and the experiences that I went through, I've written them into a memoir, but it's not ready for putting out yet. So yeah, evolution of consciousness. So there's another level to it, and that's that about 10 or 11 years ago, my kind of spiritual searching just went like that. Okay, I'll take anything. And I went on YouTube and found quite a lot of teachings and teachers, live stuff, and got to meet a few people like Tony Samara. I can't think of any names right now, but I think Advaita Vedanta, non-duality is where my heart's still with Sufism and my sheikh, but not outwardly. And Advaita is a kind of a complement to that. And I also bring mindfulness in. So I'm using a lot of mindfulness and creating my own little course. But I was quite fascinated to see the course that you've put together in the transformative dialogue. And what you're talking about sounds, I can hear coherent dialogue coming through a little bit. It looks like you've got a session on that.
Hmm.
I think it would be fabulous to find out more about that.
Very happy to. I think first I'll just express my astonishment about the details and circumstances of your life in this conversation. I think you're the first person I've met who's gone down that path. And yeah, I'm sure there's going to be an interesting conversation to develop there. For me, in my inquiry, I think the Sufi element of Islam was probably the one I came into least contact with, actually. And there was always a sense for me that there was maybe some possibility of synthesis. I'm very interested in this possibility of mystics from different traditions who are drawn to a kind of unifying principle to come into dialogue together. And of course, that can be very controversial as well. But for me, it was much more mainstream Sunni Islam, and particularly looking at, you know, what Western scholars called Islamism, political Islamic movements and modernity and jihadist movements and Salafi Islam and the relationships between them and the history of the meeting of Islam in the West and so on. And so to sort of just turn completely there to back to the dialogue. I also had come across Bohm quite recently. Actually, I had come across sort of Dialogos through John Vivekie, Jordan Hall, and others, and subsequently discovered Bohm and delved into his conversations with Krishnamurti and his book, and met a number of people who sort of learned in his dialogue lineage. I was really struck in Bohm at the way that he asked questions and entertained things that seemed really far out. And he kind of allowed Krishnamurti to just go out there and say things that were, metaphysically controversial. And Bohm would always be like, "Well, that's interesting. And let me keep going on this questioning process." And I noticed for myself, after listening to 10 or 20 hours of their dialogues, that in my private conversations, when I was getting to a point of stuckness, I was able to sort of somehow remember that Bohmian move. And when it felt stuck, to sort of ask a question and to entertain the possibility of something, and that can create movement. And so then with Elizabeth DeBald, who you were just watching my conversation with, her and Thomas Steininger, there's another wonderful strain of emergent dialogue. And I feel what I'm doing is very sort of in resonance with that. And she's a wonderful, wise woman who I've had the pleasure to speak with a few times. And for me, there's a phenomenological depth. There's an experiential depth available in dialogue that can be a bit esoteric for people, but really isn't abstract. It's not theoretical kind of stuff. It's coming into deep listening. And that listening for me is not just the kind of listening we usually speak about with the ears, but it's also listening to one's own breath, to one's own body, and there's many subtle depths with which we can do that. And then listening to the space. And that almost becomes a primary force in the dialogue beyond the speech. For me, it's sort of like allowing the foreground of what we say to arise from the background, and to really sort of rest into the deeper background, the ground of the conversation. And that ground is quite mysterious. it's really that place of not knowing that I bring people into in these courses. So what I've sought to do with that course on Dialogos and fellowship is to sort of bring together exploring different aspects of dialogue, of the experience of dialogue, of listening, of attending to the field, of speaking more in flow and exploring a more musical approach to communication. And alongside that sense of fellowship being really important, the kind of kindred spirit relationship that can develop when we as a group of men are kind of circling around a common purpose. And in the case of these courses, that common purpose is something like wisdom. Like we're going on a journey together to figure out living more wisely, and we're using dialogue to get there. And it can be very psychoactive. For me, there's a psychoactive depth to where we go, and that creates a certain palpability and quality to the experience in which we become immersed and we perhaps let go of more and more of the thought of like what's outside of the dialogue and come into a real presence with one another, where a lot can be sort of left in the unknown. And then we can sort of be in a dialogue in the unknown together. And it can be giving rise to sort of a love really between people who are participating in it, and the sense of time sort of shifting. You know, the Greeks had that idea of Kairos and Chronos, and we have sort of clock time, and then we have another scale of time that's sort of like, how meaningful is the time? And so the essence of a really good transformative dialogue is that it feels like the time really, really stretches out, and we have all the time in the world because we're so present to each moment.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
I'm interested to revisit this autism point, but I wonder if there was something coming up for you just there that you wanted to.
Just a question about koinonia. You know that phrase? Is it Japanese? No, it's Greek. It literally means impersonal fellowship. And I heard it from Peter Garrett, who was with Bohm in the early 80s and put that dialogue, a proposal paper with Don Factor, the three of them.
Is he a colleague of yours?
He is a colleague, but not directly. I met him. He and Jane Ball founded the Academy of Professional Dialogue here in I nearly said here in the UK, but it's in Gloucestershire in the UK. And that was my first formal introduction, apart from at uni, to dialogue at their inaugural meeting. And it was at the same time I came up with the idea for autism dialogue. So we've traveled the path, grown together a little bit, and I've had some involvement. I'm a member of that, and Peter talks about that. The term dialogos, I first heard of that in a similar way at one of the annual conferences of the Academy of Professional Dialogue. William Isaacs was there. the author of Dialogue and the Art of Thinking Together, Professor William Isaacs, and I got to sit with him for a bit. And that's been going. I think that he's the founder of Dialogos, the organization.
Mm.
Yeah, and interestingly, I think he'd seen my name on the list of guests and my interests, and anyway, we sat down at a dinner, and he said we introduced each other, and then I said I got my diagnosis of Asperger's, you know, autism. And he just looked to the side and he said, "You don't believe that, do you?" And I could have taken that the wrong way, but I kind of just, something in me just responded intuitively very quickly. And I said to him, "No, but I got a career out of it." And he cracked up laughing. It was a great moment, because it was like, we don't need to do labels right now.
Mm.
You know, there's an instant fellowship there, and it was a good moment. But yeah, I'm very serious about my understanding of and my inquiry into autism. That's when I thought I could, in a way, selfishly gather people together who also had an interest or you know, were invested in it or needed to know more. So that was the idea for Dialogue, and I just booked a room in the center of Sheffield, and I'd been doing some music promoting. I knew how to put on a gig, so I invited a load of people. Actually, I was supported by somebody at one of the unis, and it kicked off from there, out on the front lines in community, you know. And I felt quite vulnerable, but in a way it was always been. I got a bit of counseling training. The group, the Sufi groups, 20 years of that, sitting in circles, new people coming in all the time in the community looking for spiritual solace and support, got some experience in. So it was, felt quite natural to me. And I think the crisis of self thing was really important for, like, viewing autism as a social construct. And generally, there's this saying, you know, some people say we're all a little bit autistic, aren't we?
Hmm.
Well, I think in some ways that's true. We're all a little bit everything, aren't we? But in other ways, that disrespects the whole set of traits, the whole legacy, the whole movement, the identification that many people need to say, you know, I'm autistic, I'm different, I have struggle fitting in, I've got sensitivities, I've got some social difficulties, you know. So it's a great category.
Mm.
You may know there's no biomarker for it, so, you know, it can't be cured. It's a construct, like a lot of neurodivergence. And anyway, I could keep talking forever. You imagine that, hundreds of hours of autism dialogue, sitting with autistic people, family members, professionals, academics. I did a postgrad certificate in autism, and I did one in coaching and mentoring as well.
Hmm.
So I've done some one-to-one coaching, but yeah.
And is the autism dialogue about the experience of autism, or is it just a dialogue that's including autistic individuals?
Yeah. So autism dialogue itself has to be like a mirror of society, so it's not just autistic people. In fact, if it's just autistic people, it becomes something else, and it's very rarely that. So we usually invite family members or workers as well, and then And then it's more of a mirror of society, like a social lab to experience being. Obviously, we recognize autistic people as being a marginalized community. So there's some support for making a autism-friendly environment, whatever that is, that's co-designed. But we have to bear in mind, as facilitators, we have to bear in mind that there's a power dynamic that's out of balance in society, and we can't avoid that being part of who we are when we come into the into the dialogue as an individual, whoever we are. So we have to be, very sensitive to that.
Mm.
That's where the facilitation comes in. Yeah.
I would be interested just to hear some of the core. I mean, you've spoken to it a little bit, but what the core elements and identifiers are
of
an autism diagnosis.
Okay. Well, there's some quite common, typical ones, sensory sensitivity. So sensitive to noise, certain noises or smells or volume. And then on the social side of things, not being able to work as quickly at fitting in with conversations or understanding nuances in conversations of behavior. I read a lovely description recently. Is a little article by somebody who looked up the etymology of the word autism. I'm really interested in etymology in dialogue. I think that's the first place to go. Okay, what are the sounds that we're making?
Yeah, me too.
But for this person, it was I'll send you the article, but the summary was that autistic people are born without understanding or the insight to be able to adapt themselves to fit in. So autistic people are already themselves. They don't have to fit, they don't have to adapt and change to fit in. They don't know how. That was a really refreshing way of viewing it.
Yeah. Already this is sort of resonating for me. I definitely felt somehow odd or not quite fitting in. I wouldn't say excluded, but always a little different. And I have moved through many different social scenes and contexts in my life. And the other one, that sensitivity, which can be a gift and a curse, I think.
Yep.
For me, for example, lighting is, I'm particularly sensitized to lighting.
Yep.
Poor lighting or bad lighting for me, it can just degrade my capacity to even be in a room for very long. Used to have fun. It was funny with my last girlfriend. We would go to the supermarket, and this supermarket had just this incredibly bright LEDs and incandescent lights everywhere. And if I went in there without a hat, my capacity to do the shopping after 15 minutes was starting to fall off. So that's obviously quite challenging. In other instances, that has been sort of the doorway to being an artist, really. Sensitivity to how objects in a space are relating to one another, and the capacity to rearrange things. I think often I think a lot of autistic young people, and this is my sort of speculation based on my own experience, it can show up as like a control thing or a sort of OCD sense of like needing to have order, and often other people in the family don't have that same sensitivity. And so there's kind of a response that looks like order and control and OCD. But I think underneath that is a kind of, can be a kind of feng shui aesthetic sensitivity that's just not shared. And so there is this kind of journey of discovering like, oh, actually, you know, I'm not just OCD. I'm sort of an artist in that way. So yeah, those are just a couple of things that come up for me, and it's a sort of privilege to be able to talk about this stuff, because it, for all the dialogue I've had, this is a aspect of myself and a conversation that I've never really had.
Yeah, well, I would say that the way that before we started recording this, we had a short conversation, didn't we? And you wanted to just tune into yourself and just sit quietly with your eyes closed, totally naturally. I think that to me, although you can't separate autism from the person, but that to me is a way that sensitivity to your needs has manifested in a practice which you know is you need. It's not just something you've been taught, you know. And that's what's beautiful about the sensitive aspects of autism, where a lot of autistic people, they know what they need. They know what's good for them. And self-management, if you can do some of that, that's the kind of supportive approach that I bring into mindfulness. And when I speak about autism, social engagement system of the vagal nerve, really interesting the way the vagal the ventral vagal nerve is ear, nose, and throat. So it's to do with social engagement, the way we hear, the way we're built to be able to speak in a soothing way, and hearing a soothing voice calms down the vagus system. You know, autism's a lot to do with trauma, locked in trauma. So there's some interesting developments there, but I'm kind of picking this up as I go along, and I've brought it into my mindfulness for autism course.
I'd love to hear more about that.
I've got one starting next week, actually. I'll send you the link and to the information, you can have a look. But mindfulness has always been a part of my dialogue as well from the beginning. Always bring in at least a few minutes mindfulness at the beginning. That's always you know, crucial, I think.
Yeah, I somehow arrived at the same, you know, without anyone sort of pointing me to it. It just came that having that meditation, I call it sort of dropping in. It's such a wonderful and essential, I think, way of beginning a dialogue, because there's so much momentum and fuzz and thought, and it really allows us to create the space for something different to happen.
Yeah, I think this is the interesting convergence now, that with the dialogue, because I've been really keen for quite some time to work to not be confined to autism and the neuro, although it's the core of my practice and where I began, there's always been something universal about the nature of self. And I think you and I can have another conversation. I didn't usually want these to be more than half an hour because of people's attention spans, but I think, you know, we've been going nearly an hour and I think it's been really interesting. So if anybody's still listening, thank you for staying with this conversation. We're really enjoying it. Well, I am.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never done a 30-minute one. And I think if I had been aware that it was 30 minutes, maybe I would be like much more rapid fire. I've been accustomed to the long form, which when I started out was sometimes 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And what I've really narrowed in on is 90 minutes, whether it's recorded or session with somebody one-to-one or a group, there's something about that time. There's something that can develop and grow. And often, you know, we might go for, sometimes I go for an hour with someone and the whole hour, there can be like an ambiguity about quite what it is we're doing or where it's going. And then just in the last 10 minutes, something gathers together that sort of reframes and clarifies the whole thing up to that point. So it's fascinating, and I'm excited to hear that you're sort of broadening the horizon of this work for you. One of the sort of gifts and challenges of it for me is that it is such a fundamental core aspect of human being that it's quite hard for me to niche and to focus in, because I do see so many different possibilities of contexts, whether it's, you know, healing work, whether it's kind of creative collaborative business space stuff, or conflict mediation. There's huge potential for politics. Of course, you know, we come from a culture of debate, a politics of debate rather than a politics of dialogue, and relationships, you know, couples, marriages, like it's really community. It's, we're working at something that is so in the core relational fabric. And that's what gives me a lot of hope, is that if you can just shift, like imagine shifting that just a few degrees to the left or to the right, a bit more present or a bit more listening or curiosity, that compounded over every conversation you have to change your life, change your world, and change the experience of everyone you come into contact with.
There's a quote from Bohm you've just reminded me of. Suppose we were able to share meanings freely without a compulsive urge to impose our view or conform to those of others, and without distortion and self-deception, would this not constitute a real revelation? David Bohm.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, we've if it's all right with you, I think we're meeting in the middle between 30 minutes and 90 minutes. Almost at the 60. Do you get people staying with the whole 90 minutes listening?
I'm absolutely happy to sort of draw to a close here, but I would say that the culture of, you know, there's been a bit of a conversational renaissance, and there is a willingness now in the podcasting online space for people to go hour and a half, 2 hours, when they're really engaged with it, people will go for it. And I certainly did. I've watched hundreds of hours. So yeah, there's an aspect of meeting people where they are, and then there's also, like, you know, not limiting our expectations of what people can do.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point. Really appreciate that. Thanks so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure, a real connection.
Yeah, likewise, Johnny. It's been really nice to meet and to sort of begin this conversation.
All right, well, we can stop recording now and carry on for a few minutes.
Wonderful.
Cheers.
Thank you.